Cock, excuse me. So this is... this is a question and answer session. Yeah, would you wait for the microphone at the back? Sorry.
We have a few questions from the audience written down, so I'll start with those. Just a quick reminder, if you guys, everybody can check your phones one more time and please silence your phone, that'd be greatly appreciated. Thank you. The first question, Ajahn Jarasaro, is, could you please explain more in detail on how meditation helps with depression and how to effectively prevent negative thoughts from occurring in our mind while meditating?
Well, I think, first of all, meditation, as I say, I need to keep mentioning this point, sort of integrated into this whole education or training of body, speech, and mind, is an effective protection against depression. So the kind of obsessive thoughts that lie behind much depression don't ever take hold in the first place. As regards treating depression, I think, obviously I'm not a professional here, but I understand there's a significant distinction between kind of one-off depressions, which can often be triggered by some traumatic experience of separation of one kind or another, for instance, and chronic depression. So for the kind of one-off kind of depression, then in that case, often meditation in conjunction with meditation practices in conjunction with medication can work very well. So it's not a straight out choice of one or the other. But of the studies that I'm familiar with, in the treatment of chronic depression, as they say, depression which resurfaces at intervals throughout the person's life, that the most effective treatment of that now is something called MBCT, which is mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. I got a brief potted kind of background to this. For many years, the Freudian school of psychotherapy was dominant in the States and in the Western world. That was based upon the idea that depression is the result of repressed anger. And so therapists would try to encourage their patients to express their anger. You know, you've maybe seen like had like pillows and knives, and you say, it was a pretty disastrous failure in terms of dealing with depression, and far more because when you express anger in that way, you feed anger and make it more real than it was before, and it doesn't somehow remove the causes of depression. So far more effective, and which gradually in most places supplanted the Freudian approach is cognitive therapy, which is based upon So I'm oversimplifying here. So any of you professionals, please, sorry. But it's based upon the idea that there are certain kind of fixed poisonous or toxic thoughts in the mind, like universal thoughts like, I'm hopeless, for instance. And so experiences are interpreted within this kind of toxic framework. Every small failure is, oh yeah, there I go again, I'm hopeless. When we have some success at something, then it's a special case, anybody could do it, it doesn't mean anything. So it's a problem of perception and creating certain kinds of perceptions in the mind and identifying with them, believing in them, so they become a rut in which the mind falls. And so the cognitive therapists really seem to have something there, but it was only when they applied the mindfulness techniques borrowed from Buddhist tradition that they really had a tool by which to help people suffering from this kind of depression to recognize these kinds of thoughts as they arise and to question them and not to identify with them. So this kind of mindfulness meditation, coupled with or as part of this MBCT, is now, I think, acknowledged pretty well everywhere as being the most effective means of dealing with depression. I'm very always concerned to remind people that meditation is not some kind of wish-fulfilling jewel. It's not a magic bullet. It doesn't solve all problems. You know, just meditate and everything will be okay. I remember something always sticks in my mind is that the first time I came to America in 1991, and I visited a very large Cambodian community in Massachusetts. And I visited the abbot of one of the big monasteries there. And he was quite respected as a meditation teacher. Many of the Cambodian people who had come to America at that period were refugees from Khmer Rouge. Many of them had seen terrible things and experienced terrible things and had lost many of their loved ones. And I asked him, well, what meditation teachings do you give people with that kind of background and those kinds of problems? And he said, I think it will be quite a long time before we get there meditating. At the moment, I'm encouraging dana and sila. So in the traditional way of presenting the path of practice for lay Buddhist, these are the three categories of dana is generosity and giving, sila, training of body and mind, and then pavana, or the inner development. But he's encouraging people to perform acts of kindness and service and generosity, helping others as the most therapeutic approach. Someone has severe mental problems, getting them to sit with their eyes closed and go further into their inner world is often not a very good strategy. And that in people to find a joy in helping others and performing acts of service for which they feel a sense of accomplishment, achievement, and wholesome pride that they're doing something for others, something useful. And also keeping precepts, living within the five precepts. This is what provides the long-term foundation, which will allow someone to, who has been through some trauma or has some clinical mental health problems, to benefit from meditation. If someone really is keen to use meditation, in such a case, then I suggest the walking meditation rather than sitting meditation, going out into a park or out into the open, somewhere which is very uplifting and natural environment, and also to emphasize the loving kindness meditation, developing thoughts of kindness for oneself and for others. These are, I think, very good ways of dealing with depression.
The next question we have: if you have a lot of negative thoughts or think a lot of thoughts you can't get out of your head, what is the first step towards overcoming or diminishing that?
Don't try to get rid of them is the first thing. There's a very there's a lot of Thais in the audience, so excuse me. There's a very good Thai idiom, which is "samkhan man mai." So, you know, when you who can translate that into English? I don't think I can. So when you have some unpleasant mental state, then there are two extremes. One is just completely get lost in it, indulge in it, or be carried away by it, and the other is to try and force it out of your mind. In both ways, samkhan man mai, they actually end up feeding the mental state because they make it real. They consider it something important. So the middle way is that simple recognition that this mental state is the result of kamma. What I mean by that is, why does a particular thought keep coming up in your mind? It keeps coming up in your mind because it's come up in your mind in the past. So it's created a habit. That's all it is. It's just a habit. And if it's a habit and one that you have either welcomed into your mind and really allowed your mind to dwell upon it, or else you fought with it and tried to get rid of it, then it becomes very strong. But simply recognizing it, oh, here it is again, and neither moving towards it, moving away from it, but simply bearing with it, allowing it to be there, then when you do that, it gradually starts to fade away. Not immediately, not as quickly as you would like, perhaps, but it will do that because the way to deal with these things is to stop feeding them. But anything, when something starves, it doesn't just kind of disappear immediately. It becomes weaker and weaker. So the most important thing is don't feed it, either with obsession and fascination, or with aversion and fear. It's maintaining this equanimity and recognizing, oh, here it is again. So sometimes using some kind of label for these thoughts can be useful. For instance, you say worry mind. Yeah, so you know, if you have obsessive worries about something, and then when worry appears in your mind, just remember, worry mind. It's all it is. It's just worry mind. So it's not me. I'm so worried about this and that and what's going to happen. And if this happens, then well, that will happen. And instead of just getting caught in that long stream, endless proliferation, you just recognize it's just like somebody knocking on your door. You know, it's worry mind knocking on the door. So you don't have to fight with it, but you don't have to open the door either. You just to recognize, be very polite, sorry, I'm not free right now.
I have here another written question. It says, your talk shows understanding and relatableness to what a common layperson might be experiencing. As a monk, what do you typically do to stay current with events and happenings in the world? Are you reading newspapers, watching the news, etc.?
This will vary a lot. For monks in training, for the first many years, then teachers will try to cut off interest and in the world and worldly affairs pretty much, because there's still that strong connection and there's no need for them to be up on every single event. When I was the abbot of a large monastery, then I would get the Sunday newspaper, the Sunday Bangkok Post, and there's like the inner page which is summarized like the major stories of the week. And I found actually that was probably all you needed. You know, is to think you have to keep up with every single thing. So, but you know, it's actually a kind of an addiction, isn't it? You know, it's sort of. Ajahn Jayasaro today will be flying to Los Angeles, and then an hour later, Ajahn Jayasaro is still preparing to go to Los Angeles, and then an hour later, Ajahn Jayasaro is now in the at the airport checking in to go to Los Angeles, and an hour later, Ajahn Jayasaro is in the plane on the way to Los Angeles, and then Ajahn Jayasaro is still on the plane on the way to. And in a few hours, Ajahn Jayasaro will be arriving in Los Angeles. This is a kind of, you know, when you have this 24-hour news cycle, so much of it is of that kind of nature, you know, constantly looking for some new angle just to freshen up and to make you think you're listening to something important. So as a general point about news, I would say that news is a consumer good these days, and people consume news, and it's good to bring some attention just to how much news that you need to consume and to be able to why consume it. I mean, my father was a news addict because he was brought up to believe that was your duty as a good citizen to keep abreast of everything that's happening. So, you know, he'd listen to the news on the radio every hour on the hour, you know. And so to return to your question, when I was the abbot, I would read a newspaper on a Sunday, and then if there was anything that I thought was important, then at tea time, sit with the monks, and I would tell them, this is happening and that's happening. And every now and again, some visitor to the monastery would pass through with a Time magazine or something like that, and people would learn it and actually forbid it. But in my role as a teacher, then I do feel a need to be more or less up with what's happening in the world, because at my stage of my life as a monk and as a my position in Thailand, that many people are looking at me to me to give some kind of leadership and some kind of sense of, well, as Buddhists, how do we look at this? You know, so if there's some kind of a big debate about whether it's ethical for a government in a Buddhist society to legalize casinos, for instance, or there's some ethical and moral issues that are arising, or some, so these days there's big scandals in the monastic order. People are really genuinely want someone that they trust can say, well, how do you look at this? And how, as a Buddhist monk, and how, as Buddhists, then what is, how should we look at this? So it's not saying you should think like this or you should believe this, but saying, you know, look, investigate it in this way. This is a kind of reflections that I had. So I do keep up a lot more than I used to. And I, these days, I often read newspaper online. That's how I access. But the other thing is that, you know, as lay people, you lead very sheltered lives compared with monks. Because you know, as a lay person, your social circle tends to be very circumscribed. You tend to hang out with people who are about your age, your social background, same profession. So you tend to have quite a narrow view of the world. And these days, especially when you go online, then you go on websites or you watch things when people who have very similar ideas. So, you know, the growth of social media and everything, people are becoming more and more narrow-minded. Whereas as a monk, then people will come to see me from like the poorest people in the country to the wealthiest people in the country. People who don't have, you know, more than a few pennies to rub together to multi-millionaires. So as a monk, as a teacher, you hear and you listen to the points of view and the suffering and the opinions of people from every strata of society. So my sense of what's going on in the country, in the world, is much more based upon people I speak to, and so I know people from almost every walk of life. So if I have something that I want to find out about, then I know lawyers I can speak to, or politicians, or diplomats, or doctors, or rice farmers, or house shopkeepers, or housewives, and so I know people from so many different backgrounds that, as I say, contrary to, you know, usual kind of cliche and perceptions, actually as a monk or as a senior monk, then I have a very wide-ranging sense of the kind of finger on the pulse of the society.
The next question we have from the audience is, how do we explain nirvana, heaven and hell, to our children?
Yeah, well, let me have a drink first. I don't think you really need to very much, you know. I certainly don't want to be, you know, getting into this reward and punishment. You know, do this and you'll go to heaven, and do that and you'll go to hell. You know, that's not a Buddhist approach to teaching children or anybody. I think probably the most practical way of talking about heaven and hell is to speak in terms of everyday experience, and to say that although we, you know, we can't see heaven and hell, but heaven is a state of incredibly positive and blissful experience, and hell is a state of awful, incredible suffering. So in our daily life, there are some times where we feel so happy, you know, just really blissfully happy. And that gives you a little kind of taste of what a heaven realm might be like. And if you're in a terrible pain and anguish and despair, then that gives you a little bit of an idea of what a hell realm might be. But the most important Buddhist kind of attitude to these things, and something talking about yesterday as well, is not to be afraid of saying you don't know. It's perfectly all right to say you don't know, and you should say you don't know. So what's heaven like? What's hell like? I don't know. My criticism of many religious figures or people who are very devoted to their religion is this confusion between believing in things and knowing things. But this is a very important distinction in Buddhism. And we have a word, kind of unique word, which is Satchanuraka, which means caring for the truth. And you care for the truth by not claiming that you know something when you only believe it. So if someone says to you, oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe in reincarnation, don't you? There's this idea that Buddhism is a set of beliefs. And one of the ones that you're a Buddhist, you have to sign on for is reincarnation. That's your kind of identifying belief. But in Buddhism, what we should be saying is, well, you know, I don't know, you know, whether there are heaven realms and hell realms, and there is a rebirth in these different realms. I don't have any personal direct experience of that, so I can't claim that I know that it's true. But I do believe in it, and these are my reasons. These are the supporting reasons for my belief. For instance, the many references to it in the Buddha's words, in the Buddha's discourses, because of the recollection of past lives by many great meditators, by the recollection of past lives on the part of children throughout the world, of which over 2,500 have been gathered and sifted and sorted out by in the University of Virginia, and also people who can remember past lives under hypnosis. So I would say that given the evidence in the Buddha's teachings, the words of the Buddha himself, and the various cases of recollection of past lives by meditators, by children, by people under hypnosis, this is very powerful evidence supporting this teaching. But I cannot say, or we cannot say, that they are proofs of rebirth. They are very, I would say, weighty and convincing supports for belief in it. So this is how I think, even with children, this is a very important point to make, that we don't claim that we know something when we only believe it. So talking about heaven and hell, then I think it's important to make that point. As regards Nibbana, then one of the features of the Pali language itself is that it's the preference to phrase things in a negative form. So, but that negative form has much more of a positive state than would necessarily be the same in English. Let me see if I can find an example. In fact, if we, certain words, let's say, if we say in English, oh, he's totally impeccable, okay? So that he's not peccable at all. So peccable is not a word we don't use very much. It's a shame, actually. It's quite a nice word. Peccable means the sort of at fault, faulty. So you say impeccable, he's not at fault at all, or she's not at fault, she has no faults. But it is, strictly speaking, a negative formulation, impeccable. But the effect of the word is positive. Okay? There are a number of words that not come to mind immediately in English which are phrased in the negative way, un this, un that, in words, which actually are very positive in their emotional impact. So it's good to remember that this is very much the case, and even more the case in Pali language. So a number of words which are translated as not this, not that, you know, can all seem kind of rather narrow and negative, and that there's no kind of positive formulation. But it's as much a matter of language as anything else. So, nevertheless, talking about Nibbana, we can say it's the complete absence of greed, absence of all forms of anger and aversion, and freedom from delusion. Now, in the case of Nibbana, you really do have to use that kind of negative formulation. And an analogy might be of health, let's say physical health. If you had to explain physical health to somebody, it's very difficult to do that in a positive way. What we usually say, oh, I'm in good health, yeah, I don't have cancer, I don't have heart disease, I don't have diabetes, I don't have measles, I don't have a cough and cold, yes, well, I do. But you have to say the things that you don't have, and then you build up a bit, oh, that's what health is. And similarly with Nibbana, you say all the things that are not there. But if we look at the qualities of someone who has realized Nibbana, then it's a little more easier to speak in a positive way, because there are certain key virtues that become very prominent. And the two key ones are wisdom and compassion. Okay, so this is it's the perfection of wisdom and perfection of compassion. These are the outcomes of the realization of Nibbana. So the Buddha became the Buddha through wisdom, and after he had realized enlightenment through the perfection of wisdom, then naturally, as the natural expression of that wisdom and understanding, arose great compassion for all sentient beings, and he began his 45-year teaching journey. during which he made use of his wisdom to articulate teachings and to create a path of practice for people to follow in his footsteps. So when for the unenlightened being, our motivation is always influenced to one level or another by self-concern, a sense of self. But once the kind of self-concern is abandoned by the Arahant, it's not that he is completely without any grounds for any motivation, but it becomes a selfless motivation, that of compassion. So you can say that Nibbana as a state characterized by complete absence of all suffering and causes of suffering, but as it manifests in the human being, it is characterized by great wisdom and compassion.
I got another written question from the audience. This one says, how should we help pets upgrade their spirit since they can't practice by themselves? Thank you.
Sorry, how can we?
How should we help pets upgrade their spirit since they can't practice by themselves? Ka.
Yeah, be a good example to them. It depends. I mean, pets are close proximity to wise, compassionate human beings is probably the best influence on animals. And some animals, have it better than others. This is a venerable who sits the third monk along, Venerable Knight, who comes from Thailand. So his brothers took over the family business. It's quite stressful business. So his wife bought him this little pug, this little dog. And all he has to do when he gets stressed out is just look in the face of this dog. And it's just incredible. You look at this dog, you just want to smile, you know. So that's what I was saying, you know, like this dog is making a lot of merit, you know. It doesn't have to do anything. You just have to look at you, you know, and you feel good. And so I think he's making the, you know, creating the causes and conditions for a good rebirth in the future. But I think that it's difficult to say, but I think that pets who are around kind, compassionate, thoughtful human beings, they do absorb that to a certain, to what extent, I don't know, but then probably that's the most that we can do for them, to care for them and be a good example to them.
The next audience question is, how does one get rid of past heartbreaks and stop the anger towards that person?
Get past
heartbreaks.
Yeah, and?
And stop the anger towards that person. So I'm assuming the person that may have.
Stop feeling resentment towards that person. Yeah. Well, first of all, your heart didn't break. Because if it did, you wouldn't be here today. So good news. I think that when someone has their heart broken, or they're betrayed, or they are treated badly by someone who they've trusted and loved and made a commitment to, then it is incredibly painful, because. Probably the most painful experience as a human being is rejection. And so that experience of rejection goes right to the very heart of our kind of self-respect and self-esteem. Just as a, I don't know if anyone is familiar with the an American doctor called John Gottman. And John Gottman has written books about emotional intelligence. But he and his wife have for many years run a marriage laboratory. And what they do is they get married couples to sit facing each other over a table, and they're wired up to all these kind of monitors and there's a video camera, and then they have an argument. And, you know, not something that's, you know, like crucial to their relationship, but, you know, some kind of niggling little issue about, you know, who takes out the garbage or something like that. And they say that within 3 minutes of watching a couple having this kind of exchange, they're like kind of a 90% accurate prediction of whether there'll still be a couple in 5 years' time. And so they have a list of like danger signals, which say this relationship is on the rocks or may not last. And number one is not kind of expressions of aggression, but it's expression of contempt. So that's the number one poisonous, toxic element in a relationship. If one person expresses disrespect and contempt for the other person, which is a kind of rejection, isn't it? There's no rejection of you as a thoughtful, reasonable, intelligent human being. So if someone, you say something and the other person, like eye rolling is like, that's awful, you know. Oh, here we go again, you know, that kind of thing. This kind of sense of rejection is painful, most painful. But as I mentioned just now, that with any kind of residue in the heart from something that's happened in the past, right now, what is it? It's a recurring memory, a recurring perception, which arises and passes away in your mind. That's what it is in real time. And so you have a choice of how to deal with that perception, whether you're going to, when it comes up, you just allow yourself to be the mind to just go into this long string of thoughts and anger and memory that you've accumulated and just make yourself feel terrible, or to try to force it out of your mind and repress it and not think it at all. And so again, the simple method is not to feed it, simply to recognize, yeah, after an important relationship comes to an end, there are going to be, particularly if it comes to an end in an unhappy way, there are going to be a residue there, and that as long as you keep feeding it, it's never going to go away. So, you know, are you ready to let go of it? Because I think it's often the case that why we don't let go of things is often because one part of us doesn't want to let go. There's still this kind of indulgence in the pain. You start to be very, very honest with yourself whether you really do genuinely want to get rid of that pain or to be free of that pain, in which case, you know, don't feed it anymore. If you have you know, some simple reflections also, if after being together for a certain while, somebody breaks your heart, then maybe think, well, better then than another year down the road or another few years. Or if at that time, for instance, you had no children, you think, well, it's good that I found out what kind of person they are then before, you know, we settled down and had a family, for instance. Or, you know, there are always ways of thinking, well, you know, that was always going to happen given that person's personality or our personality. And is so I think that, you know, one way of looking at relationships is more like chemical reactions. And that sometimes, you know, two chemicals come together and there seem to be quite a good chemical reaction. But then maybe that chemical actually reacts much better with another chemical. This may seem a kind of weird analogy, but what I'm trying to say is it's not like you're no longer lovable because that person decides they love somebody else. It's not a statement about who you are as a human being. It's about this kind of mysterious thing about what attracts and repels human beings, which is only partly conscious. And so it's at the end of the day, as we say, it's what's happened. It's like this. What are you going to do about it? And that's the freedom, you know, whether you're just going to carry something around and feel miserable, or whether you're going to stop doing that. And there is really that kind of choice to be made. It's not that, you know, don't allow yourself to feel you're a victim of somebody else's actions. Nobody can make you suffer, ever. People can make your life very uncomfortable, but finally, the suffering in the heart is also always directly dependent upon some kind of craving. So if somebody does something, they betray you, they mistreat you, for instance, then that's a condition for suffering, but it's not the cause of suffering. So the cause of suffering is you don't want them to do that, or you cannot accept that they've done that. Your pride is hurt, for instance. That's the actual cause of the suffering, and that's something that you can do something about. So the shabby behavior of other people, the unkind, the cruel behavior, selfish behavior, that's not something that you can do about. But those are only supporting conditions or triggers for suffering. They're not actually the cause. And that's where the freedom or the possibility of freedom from this kind of pain can arise.
Next audience question is, how do you deal with like and dislike?
Yeah, they're just, that's all they are. I mean, we're living in a time and a place where huge importance is placed upon likes and dislikes. You know, people portray, you know, your the image that you promote or you to the world now is in terms of, I'm a person who likes this, this, and this, and I don't like that. That's who I am. Or, and here are the Facebook likes. You know, this is like, you like this, and is it like something? So what? Yeah, that's all right. I mean, it's just you like or you dislike something. There is always going to be likes and dislikes, but it's how much importance you give to those things or how much you identify with them. But the important reflection, I think, is always there are certain things that we like and give us pleasure, but which are causes of suffering in the long run. And there are other things which we dislike, which in the long run can bring be a great benefit towards us. So therefore, given that things that we like can either be for our long-term welfare and happiness or for our long-term welfare and suffering, and similarly with dislikes, then it doesn't make sense. It's unwise to take our likes and dislikes as a criteria for action, that we have to be able to stand back from, yeah, I like it, but, you know, is it right? I like it, but is it wise? I like it, is it compassion? I like it, but how much is, you know, a reasonable amount? I dislike it, but, you know, does that necessarily mean that it's a bad thing? I dislike it, but are there some hidden benefits in it? So if we're just taking those, like, very transitory, superficial feelings of liking and disliking as our guides in how to live our life, then we're on very dangerous ground, I think. Sometimes liking and disliking are giving us important information about things that will suit us and are appropriate, but not always. And also, I think it's good to remember, I think all of us have things in our life which we started off, which we really disliked, and then over the course of time, for one reason or another, we came around to really like, whether those are things or people. And similarly, people and things that we started off liking, and after a while, we found we didn't like them so much after all. So, you know, it's not you have to do anything about likes and dislikes, but to understand liking and disliking, and not to make too much out of it.
The next question is, how do you deal with addictions, including gambling, sex, drugs, or even money?
Don't get started. It's just keep away from them. I don't think there's any kind of easy answer there, and it's something you have to really answer on a case-by-case basis. And, some people, the addiction is so strong that, they're going to need medication, or they're going to need psychotherapy, they're going to need a lot long-term support. But I think that one point can make is that any change of behavior really only take place when the person themselves clearly acknowledges that they have a problem and they have to really want to do something about it. If they don't, then it's never really going to work. But the supportive conditions, good friends, are essential. I think that myself that when that when that I would say that as human beings we have a very profound need for inner peace, for a spiritual dimension to our lives. And when you neglect that spiritual dimension, your life becomes hollow and meaningless. And that is the the point at which many people fall into addictions. They're trying to fill a gap in their life that they don't know how to deal with. So, one of the advantages of meditation as a prophylactic, as you know, rather than as a sort of a first aid treatment, is that you're trying to give people access to this inner sense of well-being and flourishing within, which is independent of forms and sounds and odors and experiences, and letting people see, yeah, this is something within me, this sense of calm and contentment and this bright, clear, happy feeling is something that I can experience by letting go of negative mental states and developing mindfulness and meditation. And that, once you have that confidence based upon even an initial experience, can transform your relationship to sensual pleasures of all kinds. You don't have this kind of desperate, kind of grabbing, kind of I need something, anything to fill this kind of hole inside me, which is unfortunately how many people feel. There's an English idiom I'm sure you're familiar with: better the devil you know than the better devil you don't. So many people who become addicted, whether it's to cigarettes, to alcohol, to gambling, to whatever, it's not that they're so foolish that they don't see the danger and the damage, but it's more like, yeah, this is a very unsatisfactory thing in my life, but at the end of the day, it's better than nothing at all. So this idea that something, anything, is better than nothing, this is kind of what fuels a lot of addiction. So if you can be encouraging children from early age to develop this kind of spiritual dimension and to have some sense of inner calm, inner peace, which they can access through mindfulness or meditation techniques, then you are protecting them against that falling prey to the sense of inner emptiness that needs to be filled up with something, anything at all.
We're going to stop for a 15-minute break right now, and then we'll conclude at 3:30 for another sitting meditation.
We can carry on a bit longer if there are more questions. It's only here once every 5 years or so. Is it? Are there anybody want to ask just without writing question down? It's like a typo. Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
You said earlier that you come in contact with many different people, from the wealthiest of the wealthy to the poorest of the poor.
Mm.
As a monk, as a leader, because you have access to so many different kinds of people, do you have something personal, like an agenda that you feel like you need to move people towards, or because there's such a disparity in the people that you deal with on a daily basis? Is there I'll say just something that you want to push those people towards?
No, it's very much individually based, and of course, as I mentioned before, I'm just a Buddhist monk, not an evangelical, so it's not the going out towards these people. So the people who are coming to see me are all people already of some interest and have some identification as Buddhists. So But one of my views is that okay, let me go back a bit. It's going to be a strange kind of way into this, but the communist period, there was no communist countries, okay? No country ever considered itself a communist country. They called themselves socialists, like USSR was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So for these countries, communism was an ideal that they were moving towards, and socialism was one of the steps towards communism. I mean, people outside that world will call them communists, but they themselves consider themselves socialists on the way towards true communism. So why I bring this up is that I take issue with the idea, common idea, that Thailand is a Buddhist country. I don't think it's a Buddhist country, but I think it has a huge potential to be one. And so the question is, does Thailand want to be a Buddhist country? And what does that mean? There is some sometimes problems in Thailand are put at the door of Buddhism, or say, oh, well, it's because it's a Buddhist country that it's like this and like that. I don't think that's fair or accurate. That I think it's more that there has been a falling away and a corruption of Buddhist values in Thailand, and that if Buddhist values were clarified and articulated in a more modern way, then it would be the wisest path for the country as a whole. So I'm not sort of promoting this as an agenda, but this has occasioned some, you know, it's a kind of idea that I have. For instance, there is a word in Pali language used by the Buddha, which is suvaccho. I don't know if any of the Thai people know this word, suvaccho or suvaccha. And the usual Thai translation of this word is puwa ngai, son ngai. So it's someone who is easy to admonish, easy to teach. So this is considered a virtue. But when you translate this word, it seems to be a virtue for junior people. It's a virtue that teachers and leaders like to instill in their followers. You know, you should be puwa ngai son ngai. You should be easy to admonish. But in fact, I believe that the original meaning of this term would be more accurately rendered as easy to talk to. So that's not something just for junior people. So in a hierarchical society like Thailand, for instance, you know, maybe somebody says they don't feel comfortable about the way that a leader is behaving, and you say, "Shall I say something?" "No, mekla, don't. I don't dare. I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to. You know, it's like I'll get kicked out." You know, but then every now and again, you know, you say, "Japu di me." Shall I say something? You said, "Ah, pull by the tan pull ngai, tan pull dai." Yeah, that's like suwacho. You know, it's a leader who's open to feedback. So
one of the things I'm saying recently in Thailand is, you know, the idea of feedback and leaders receiving feedback from junior people is not at all like an alien or Western tradition which would never sort of catch on in Thailand. In fact, it's at the very heart of Buddhist tradition. And for example, in the Vinaya, the code of discipline, there are various duties and responsibilities for a new monk towards his preceptor. And there are, you know, things like helping to wash his robes, carrying his bowl and arms around, doing all these various acts of service to this gesture of gratitude and respect. But there is also a point that if a newly ordained monk or a junior monk sees his preceptor acting inappropriately, it is his responsibility to go to the teacher and express his discomfort or his concern. In other words, to give feedback. If he does not do that, he commits an offense against the Vinaya. So this idea of junior people giving feedback to seniors is right there in the heart of Buddhist tradition as expressed in the Buddhist monastic code. And that's not the only example. So this is something I say, you know, that there are so many important values that we've kind of got lost by the way, by the that we don't need necessarily be looking elsewhere, but to be more more interested in our own tradition. And our own tradition is incredibly wealthy, is rich in insights and things that we can make use of in the modern world. So yeah, as a leader, I'm you know, I often say it's like, you know, if a doctor gives a patient a course of antibiotics, you know, and says, you know, you've got to take the whole course, you know, it's not that once you get feeling a little bit better, you stop, because if you do that, then before very long, the condition will reestablish itself and it'll be even more difficult to get rid of. So my analogy here is that in Thailand often, you know, we've just, the whole sort of course of medicine that the Buddha gave, we just take like a few pills until we feel a bit better and then stop taking them. So over the course of time, these problems keep recurring and people start to lose faith in the medicine itself, when in fact the problem is that not taken the whole course of medicine that the Buddha prescribed for us. Yeah. So, I mean, as a Buddhist leader, my job is to interpret the Buddhist teachings, explain the Buddhist teachings, and try to articulate them in such a way that people living in the modern world can.
Thank you so much for your valuable teachings today. And I have a question regarding to the fear that arises during the meditation practice and the fear of seeing the truth of the body and the mind that becomes the fear that to become even aware of like oneself.
Sorry, it's difficult for me to hear.
My question is regarding to the fear that arises during the meditation,
uh-huh.
and how to overcome the fear.
I think one way of dealing with this is to recollect before you begin the meditation practice that whatever appears to the mind during meditation is simply that. It's an appearance. It's something that has a beginning and has an end. And that it and is not in any way dangerous to you. And if it was, then meditation teachers from the time of the Buddha onwards would be cautioning people, don't meditate because this terrible thing might appear in your mind. So just to sit and just to think through these things that all the great masters who have extensive meditation experience have experienced these kind of things, and they assure us that as long as we don't identify with them, don't grasp onto them, simply see them as mental phenomena, that they are in no way dangerous. People who become who meditate with gaining ideas that they want to experience certain things and see certain things, then their mind is ready to grasp onto mental images and phenomena and make something of them and then become mentally unbalanced. But if you have right view, right understanding, and you know that whatever arises passes away and that's not who you are, then that's all you really need to know. The most effective protection against fear is loving kindness. So do a lot of loving kindness meditation. And if there's any phenomena that arises in a meditation that is disturbing, then you send feelings and thoughts of loving kindness towards that that image, that phenomena, and that will deal with the fear.
Do you have time for one more question, Prajan?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that this is simple instinct for survival. You know, there's these instincts of for survival, for food, for sex, for procreation. These are not defilements as such. So what makes human beings special in Buddha's point of view is that we all have all the same kind of instincts as animals. And yet, we can transcend them. So we're not conditioned by those instincts. We don't have to be. So even the most basic kind of instinct, so let's say the sexual instinct of human being that when a meditator, a monk or a nun or someone reaches a certain level of attainment, then that completely disappears. It's not even subliminally present anymore. So I think many doctors or physiologists would argue with that, but from those within the Buddhist tradition, then there would be a very strong assertion that that's true. So, you know, there are certain a certain instincts which will always be there. You know, the instinct to eat, to survive, and these kinds of things. But the relationship to them on the part of human being can change, can be transformed through Buddhist teachings. Whereas I don't believe that's possible for animals. That's why it's a lower birth. They're very much the prisoner and the slave, if you like, of their instincts. So it means that as we're talking about just now, the scope and the possibility to make good karma or to leave that realm is very tough. Usually it's just the karma expires, the karma to be born in that state expires and then allows for a better rebirth afterwards. What is the hell realm? Yeah. Yeah. No, not necessarily, no. Well, this rebirth is incredibly complex. It's not just so simple as that. And there are things like the results of karma which are experienced in the present life. There are also results of karma in the next life and in future lives. And there are so many different strands and conditions that come to play that there are very few actions which you can say because of that action that person will definitely be reborn in that state after death. So the ones that the Buddha did distinguish particularly is if you had someone to kill the mother or kill your father or kill an arahant, then the karmic result of that is so dire that no matter what good things you might do afterwards, you could not prevent the rebirth in hell realm. But short of that, it's incredibly flexible, and this is why the teaching about Angulimala is so memorable. So this is Angulimala who, through becoming disciple of a teacher who told him that, you know, you can be free from all attachment by killing people, and he killed a huge number of people, 99 or 999, depends, until he met the Buddha, and then following that, he became an arahant. So I think one of the reasons why that story is, you know, such a prominent one is it's saying that even like a serial killer is not necessarily going to go to a hell realm after death. So, I mean, Angulimala may be the only serial killer in history, you know, whoever, you know, became an arahant or something. But the point is that it's a potential for change and for to transform your life after you've done very bad things, even murder. So it's not, oh, he's committed a murder or he's done a very bad thing, therefore he's going to be reborn there or there. It's so much more complex than that. And they're not really separable, because with delusion as a basic cause, then anger appears. So there's no anger without delusion. And similarly, greed. I mean, these are deluded mental states. Mm. The Buddha says, don't spend too much time thinking about this. Your head will explode. Yeah. But what you can observe, let go, like, to what we can really observe. Let's say you're at work and there's this really obnoxious person there, and you really have to be patient with them, and you really try to restrain yourself, and then one day maybe you're a bit tired or you're a bit this and you're a bit that, and you lose it and you shout at them, okay? Then the next time that they start behaving in a really obnoxious way, the likelihood that you will shout at them again is now been increased. It's more likely because you've done it once before. And if you've done it twice, then it's quite likely you'll do it three times. And if you've done it more than three times, even become a habit. This is karma in real life. This is how we, through a strong intention, we create habits. And those habits start to affect a whole quality of life and who we are in the world. And similarly, when you act in a, let's say you formerly been very unkind to somebody, and then when they no, this is just not right. And you make a real effort to be kind to them. And you really have to force yourself, you know. But once you've done it once, and then you do it again, it's a bit easier. Certain times a bit easier. And then before long, it's what we call second nature. There are so many of these things that people take so seriously and say, this is who I am. They're often, all our habits. Habits that we can change if we apply ourselves correctly. So this is one way of looking at karma that we can verify in our life. When we start talking about past lives and future lives, it's just speculation, really. And I'm not sure it's that helpful. Yeah. Okay, so for the last 20 minutes, let's all just sit quietly for a period of meditation.